see if this goes. This is a recording for the Purdue University Archives of an interview between Vice President for Finance, Lytle J. Freehafer, and Professor Eccles of the History Department, made in Mr. Freehafer's office in the Executive Building on June 22nd, 1970. Well, Mr. Freehafer, let us start out this morning by asking you the first and simplest question: where were you born, where were you educated, and then would you talk about how you came to Purdue and your experience and background and preparation for the job that you now have?
I was born in Texoma, Oklahoma, but I only was there a few months. My parents came back to Huntington, Indiana. I grew up in Huntington, graduated from Huntington High School.
What year?
In 1927. Got a Rector Scholarship to DePauw University, was graduated from DePauw University cum laude in economics in 1931. While I was there, I was editor of the campus newspaper, a member of Sigma Delta Chi, Blue Key, Alpha Delta Gamma, the economics honorary, and so on.
What was your social club? Did you want to?
I was a member of Lambda Chi Alpha social fraternity. Following graduation from DePauw, incidentally, I put myself largely through school by laying brick. I had learned the trade. My father was in a carpenter and in the construction business. So I got out of the university in 1931, and this was in the midst of depression, and I laid brick the first summer with an A.B. degree. That was the only thing I could find to do at the time. Finally, I got a job as a bookkeeper for a construction company, and then after the campaign of 1932, when Roosevelt was elected president and Paul McNutt was elected governor of Indiana, I got a job in the state auditor's office, where I was supervisor of audits and then the deputy auditor of state. While I was deputy auditor of state, I was called into the service. I had an ROTC commission and had some training in manpower procurement. So as soon as the Selective Service Act was passed in 1939, I was called into service immediately and served for some 5 years and 10 months in the Selective Service Headquarters. I went in as a captain and came out as a colonel.
This was in Washington, or
Indiana State Headquarters. My permanent headquarters was always there, although I served a while in Washington and a while at Fort Hays, Ohio. When I got out of the service, I went back to the State Board of Accounts, which, of course, as you know, audits all of the units of government in the state of Indiana, including the universities, townships, counties, and so on, and served as an auditor with the State Board of Accounts until I was appointed budget director for the state of Indiana by Governor Schricker.
In what year?
That was in 1949. I served 4 years as budget director, and then came to Purdue University following that term as budget director. While I was budget
director. What year did you come to Purdue?
I came in January 1953. While I was budget director, I was responsible to a large degree for writing into the Budget Act the paragraph that directed the four state institutions to get together and submit joint budgets. This grew out of a battle between Indiana University and Purdue University over a supplemental appropriation. Indiana University had overspent its appropriation during that previous biannual period by some $1 million. Purdue University had not done so. Purdue took the position, of course, that they should not be penalized because they didn't go ahead and violate the law and overspend their appropriation. So this got to be quite a battle in the General Assembly with alumna and administrative officers at the two institutions, and so on. So we wrote into the act this paragraph that directed the four state institutions to get together. Of course, following this direction on the part of the General Assembly, the four state schools did get together. Following such a battle, of course, it was a very difficult 4 or 5 years until they were able to work out anything that amounted to anything as far as joint recommendations were concerned. However, as this did develop, and as some of the personalities that were originally involved retired, moved on, the four state institutions did get together and continued to make joint requests.
Was this a wise procedure?
Very. I think that we all gained materially by this, because while we battled out among ourselves what the requests would be, and they were ultimately ended up largely based on a mathematical formula of cost per students, which everyone could buy, added to which was requests for special things such as salary increases for faculty, new programs of various kinds, etc., etc. All schools then would join together and fight jointly for what they had agreed to. This went on until the Brannigan administration, when there was a policy change and they decided to request programmatic budgets from the various state institutions and requested that they be submitted separately.
Is this change wise?
I don't believe that it has been particularly helpful to higher education in Indiana. Programmatic budgets, many people talk about them as being a new thing, and they were popularized, of course, by McNamara when he was in the Department of Defense. However, programmatic budgeting has been in existence for many, many years, and really, in the case of a complex institution like Indiana University and Purdue University, it is largely meaningless, because there is no one in the state government, in the state budget office, or in the General Assembly is really qualified to review a programmatic budget request and make the kinds of educational decisions that only experts can make. So my personal feeling, after many years of experience with budgeting, is that this has been of no particular benefit to Purdue University. We send reams of paper down there. Our last biannual budget request was a stack of paper about 5 feet high. Obviously, the people in the budget department do not have time to go through this pile of information and are not competent to make the decisions that need to be made. So I just can't see that this has been a great benefit.
Well, is there any value financially to it, to the state, to have it done in this way?
I can see no value at all to the state of Indiana financially.
Does it save money?
It costs money to do all this, obviously, to get all this material together, all the facts and figures, and then no one looks at them.
Well, then, would you advocate going back to the joint budget?
I think if this could be accomplished, this would be beneficial to everyone.
And to the state.
Right.
Well, while we're on this, would you like care to make any comment about the state of Indiana and its support of higher education?
I think the state of Indiana, until the last session of the General Assembly, the 1969 session, had a very good record of supporting higher education. And I think this was a function of the four-school method of cost per student, which people could understand. And I think it we had an environment that was favorable to higher education. Of course, I think that environment has completely changed now, both in the state of Indiana and nationally, for that matter.
Well, of course, nationally is one of the things that is interesting because of the riots, etc. But within the state, wasn't this done by the citizens of the state electing a slate or governor to higher office dedicated to the promise that costs of education were too high and he wasn't going to increase them and so on?
Well, this limitation of expenditures as far as the present governor is concerned wasn't necessarily limited to higher education. It was, he was going to hold down taxes, period, which meant holding the line in all areas, not just in higher education. The result, of course, so far in the current administration has been increases in tuition, with the student paying a much higher percentage of the cost of his education and the state of Indiana paying less.
Is this desirable for state institutions?
Historically, of course, state institutions were designed to have no or very little tuition and fees under the general theory that education was a benefit to society in general, and the public should support it almost completely. This, of course, the present situation, of course, has changed that historic theory. I personally, of course, don't think it's good, because I think society does benefit materially.
Is this peculiar to Indiana, or are other states doing the same thing?
No, the same thing is happening across the nation. It's a national phenomenon. I expect 75, 80, maybe more percent of the institutions in the country, public institutions we're talking about, had to increase fees in the last year or two.
That's because money from taxes and other public sources just was not forthcoming. And of course, we all know the cost of service and the cost of education has not been checked or stopped, has it?
That's right. And of course, as long as we have continued runaway inflation as we have had, it is not going to be stopped. There's nothing magic about the operation of a university that you can avoid inflation when the rest of society is faced with it. The university faces exactly the same problems as far as inflation is concerned that any business faces. So as long as we have this, the costs of education are going to increase, just like the cost of everything else is increasing.
I don't want to hurry you, but would you like to get on to the topic of the great problem of meeting university costs and what some of them are, and in preparing a university budget, what your problems are and those of your staff?
Of course, the university budget is made, like many others, in that we estimate our income from all sources, the state of Indiana, student fees, gifts, grants, sales, services, and so on. We set up our costs, current costs of doing business. We add for the following year, the budget year, those items of cost that are unavoidable, that have to be covered. For example, price of coal has jumped materially every year for the last several years. Matter of fact, we're even having trouble buying it at any price currently. But you have to take care of this type of cost for the whole institution. After you've covered these costs and have deducted them from your income, your ongoing costs plus the additional ones that are unavoidable, then what's left is available for faculty salary increases, for new programs, and so on and on and on. In the last few years, there has been nothing left for any substantial new programs. Matter of fact, we've had trouble trying to upgrade the library because of lack of funds. And we've made a policy for a number of years, the number one priority being faculty salary increases. When this is taken care of, that is about it as far as costs are, as far as amount of money that's available is concerned.
And really, what you're saying is that plant costs rise rapidly. These are fixed costs in a sense.
Right.
And in a sense, also your faculty salaries are fixed costs, aren't they?
That's right.
And when you get through with those, under present circumstances, it is almost impossible to develop new programs.
That's right.
Well, isn't that what this university exists on, is new programs?
Certainly, if you're going to maintain a viable educational institution, you have to pick up the new programs that are in your field. For example, Purdue historically has been a great engineering school. When nuclear engineering came along, if we had not gotten into this, we would have been avoiding or not keeping up with engineering across the board as we had historically done. Now we're in a spot where if something major of this kind happened, I don't think we'd be in a position to take care of it.
Now, a great deal has been criticized at Purdue, saying that it is too much actual application. That is, Purdue seeks and works for industrial firms who wish to have specific problems solved and will put money into only the solution and not into pure science or pure research. Is this true?
I don't believe this is true. We got into, many years ago, the matter of testing materials and so on, and this is kind of a minor operation. Our general policy, as you perhaps know, is not to accept that kind of applied research project in the university. It's normally handled by outside firms. And the gifts and grants we receive, as a matter of policy, have to contribute toward graduate education in some form. And normally we do not accept the kinds of applied research that you're mentioning.
Well, now, does this limit the income to the university from outside sources?
Well, perhaps to some degree, but why should the university involve itself in applied research when it contributes nothing to the program of the university?
All right. Are there sources of income outside of gifts from individuals, alumni, and institutions like the Ford Foundation? I know that the institution that I'm to which I'm chairman of the advisors, have given, well, and will give, around $1,600 a year to Purdue for lectures in the field of philosophy. Do we have a lot of that kind of income here?
Yes, we have a number of special grants of this kind across the university for specific lectures. I believe almost every school has several such gifts and grants. In one or two cases, bequests have been made for this purpose. I think in your department, Louis Sears left most of his fortune to Purdue University, and a portion of the income is used for this purpose.
Well, it has been used for promotion of conferences, not
right.
directly for history, but however,
right.
it's been used
in
a very
area.
Worthy manner, yes. All right. What's the future now of this? Well, we're talking about income and increased income payments to the students. This gets involved in out-of-state students and their fees.
Right. And, of course, this has been an ongoing and continuing problem in the state of Indiana. The amount of pressure varies over the years depending on the personalities of the members of the Budget Committee and the General Assembly and the Governor. We have always, because of our reputation in various areas, had many more non-resident student applications than we can accept. A number of years ago, because of the pressures from the General Assembly, we limited the entering freshman class to 25% of the entering students. Consequently, this is done on the basis of their status in their high school graduating class and the college boards. Great, if it was not limited, we would have many, many more non-resident students than we do have. Of course, non-resident tuition is much, much higher than resident students, $700 a year for residents, $1,600 a year for non-residents. And of course, this additional amount of income is helpful, but we never would dare get ourselves in the position where we, if we got too tight, that we could, that we'd have to turn down state students and accept non-resident students.
You are bound by law, are you not, to take qualified residents of Indiana?
Right, right.
Because our duty is to the
first to the our own state. Right.
State. All right.
Want to stop?
While we're talking about income and administration, what about your job as treasurer? Is there anything unique or unusual about it as compared to, let's say, corporation treasurers or treasurers of a state?
The treasurer of Purdue University is a special, rather unique job in that it's set up. It's a statutory job set up by the statutes of the state of Indiana in the original statute that set up the university. The treasurer is specifically and personally responsible for all the properties and funds, trusts, and so on of the university. And he is under what is known as a faithful performance bond. This is not an honesty bond. He's also under an honesty bond, as are other members of the staff. But he's under a faithful performance bond, which is a totally different kind of thing, in that he can be held liable under his bond for failure to faithfully perform all the duties outlined. At Purdue, the treasurer has a responsibility of all the funds, investments, the trust administration. He's responsible for the internal auditing program. He has charge of the physical plant. All of the financial administration of the university, purchasing, contracts, real estate, clerical and service personnel, administration. He has responsibility for all of the residences, food service, and housing in all the residences in the Purdue Memorial Union. This means responsibility for all graduate and undergraduate housing, as well as married student housing and so on. This is not the way most universities are operated, in that in many cases the dean of men or dean of women or dean of students have responsibility for operating the university residence. Here at Purdue we have one management program, and we're responsible not only for the financial operation of the housing and food services, but also for student counseling in those areas and so on. So that a manager of a residence hall has to look at the total picture and not just part of it when he's running a residence hall operation. And then the treasurer, of course, is responsible for the service enterprises or self-supporting enterprises at the university, like the airport, the transportation service, the duplicating service, and the photographic service.
Excuse me,
go ahead.
I was going to ask you, does this include the Purdue Research Foundation, too?
No, and I might, as an aside, say that my predecessor was treasurer of the Research Foundation and also treasurer of the university. Since the two organizations do business together, with each other, I thought that this was not appropriate because you're in an impossible conflict of interest position representing two different organizations. So I asked not to be made treasurer of the Purdue Research Foundation. I'm a member of the membership corporation, but I do not hold an office. Consequently, I'm not in a conflict of interest situation when I do business with the Research Foundation. In addition, the treasurer is responsible for the legal relationships of the university and also the legislative relationships.
You mean you're responsible for the not only the financial accounting, but also for statement of policy?
Right.
Within your area of finance?
Right.
Does this mean lobbying too?
Yes, this means some lobbying. However, I serve as the chairman of what's known as the President's Legislative Advisory Committee, which is composed of faculty and administration, in which we make policy decisions about legislative problems of all kinds. And of course, this matter of legislation and lobbying involves, many people think it involves only the budget. As a matter of fact, of the hundreds and hundreds of bills that are introduced into the legislature each 2 years, I read all of the titles and descriptions of every act that's introduced, and we pull out probably a couple hundred of these that might relate to us, and read the bills in detail, and we end up usually following about 50 or 60 in detail. In many cases, a bill is written that would affect the university, although there was not that intention when it was originally written, and we have to go on with the problem of getting it amended so that we're not affected. Now, to go on with the other, some of the other relationships that the treasurer has, I mentioned Purdue Research Foundation. There's the Ross Aid Foundation, which of course is the corporation that was originally set up to finance the Ross Aid Stadium, but has now been used to build parking garages on this campus, to build buildings on the regional campuses, to acquire land for the university at regional campuses and here.
Now, may I just interrupt for the benefit of the tape? You are also responsible at this time for all regional campus finance.
Oh, yes. The treasurer cannot avoid this responsibility because it's written into the statute. Unless or until a regional campus is some way spun off or the treasurer is relieved of this responsibility, he has the responsibility for the physical plant, business management, and so on at each of the five campuses of the university. In addition to the Ross Aid Foundation, in relationships with them, which are directly involved, of course, with property transactions, and the Ross Aid Foundation, incidentally, is a tax-exempt corporation, too. And we use it for long-range financing of a number of projects. The Purdue Aeronautics Corporation is another, which the treasurer has had continuing responsibilities. The Indiana Purdue Foundation of Fort Wayne, which was a foundation that was developed jointly with IU, Indiana University, Purdue University, and the local citizens of Fort Wayne, who contributed money to buy the original plot of ground on which the Fort Wayne campus is located, joined together to make this foundation, to form this foundation, and it's the foundation that holds title to the land and the original building. I'm treasurer of that foundation. Purdue Academic Facilities Foundation is another one that was formed to meet the requirements of a federal act for developing the North Central Regional Campus. We have relationships, of course, with McClure Park and the Research Park north of the campus, so that the treasurer's involved with a number of these outside corporations.
Now, may I just interrupt for a moment and say on the tape that in an appendix, a chart or graph, an outline and description can be added of these duties at this time.
If you want to stop it a minute.
May I ask a question that has occurred in the course of your description of your job and duties? How does this job as treasurer of Purdue, defined by legislative enactment, differ from treasurers of other Indiana universities or of other state universities in general?
Well, in most state universities, the treasurer is not a statutory officer. He is not directly responsible to the Board of Trustees for financial matters, but is responsible only to the president and through the president to the board. Now, as a matter of actual operation, I do work through the president, as far as the statute is concerned, I'm treasurer of the Board of Trustees and responsible to them. And there are very few such statutory offices in public institutions, and of course none in private institutions.
When was this statute enacted?
It's in the original statute in 1869, I believe. I better look that up.
That is when Purdue was created as a land-grant school. Is this true of other land-grant colleges, for example?
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily.
It depends on how the act is written by the General Assembly of the state in question. Of course, the treasurer of a public institution is different than the treasurer of a business in that the treasurer of a public institution is circumscribed by all kinds of laws on how funds must be accounted for and how expenditures must be made. Perhaps you can describe this briefly by saying in a business you can do almost anything that isn't prevented specifically by statute, whereas in a public operation you can do only what is prescribed by statute. This makes the treasurer's job a much more circumscribed operation in a public business.
Yet, obviously, with changes in education, with the growth of the university, and changes in directions in education, your job changes constantly. Would you like to talk about that a little?
Well, yes. The volume first is the first thing I think of that has changed. I looked up the figures when I became treasurer of the university. The total budget in 1960-61 was $47 million. The total budget this coming year is $148 million. So that in that 10 years, the operating budget of the university has tripled.
This is not just due to inflation, is it?
No, it is not. And the size of the institution, of course, has more than doubled during that same period. Then as for on the matter of volume, when I became treasurer in 1961, the indebtedness of the university was slightly over $40 million. Its indebtedness now is about $104 million, or it has gone up roughly 2.5 times. This means that we have had a tremendous building program during this period. It outstrips any other period in the history of Purdue University as far as the number of buildings that are built. And I'm talking about, of course, all of the 5 campuses. During this period we've built a number of buildings and have started a number of others at the regional campuses. Our endowment has gone from $6 million to $18 million. It's tripled during this period. So this means a bigger operation. The value of the physical plant has gone from $130 million to over $300 million. This means more buildings to take care of. It means more problems as far as complexity of operation in the many departments, and it means managing a debt service that involves $10,000 a day interest alone on the total debt of the university. You can go on mentioning many of these things that have changed over the...
May I interrupt with a question of just sheer curiosity? One of our sister institutions used to have signs out in front of the building. This building costs the state of Michigan nothing. I'm talking about Michigan State.
Right.
And it is financed by the university. We have not gone that route?
Not as far as putting out signs, but if you have looked at the map of Purdue University, put this in the appendix if you'd like to, the map of this campus, we divide this up and say this and give the total amount of funds appropriated by the state of Indiana and the total funds provided for other sources. Now last June 1 on the map for this campus alone, the state had appropriated $57 million, and there had been funds provided from other sources of $129 million. So we always and continually talk about this to people, legislators and the public, but people just don't remember it. They come on the campus and they look around and say, well, look at these lovely residence halls and this stadium and the field house and all the rest of it that the taxpayers of the state of Indiana have provided for Purdue University. As a matter of fact, they've provided only for the five campuses, they've provided only about 20% of the total costs of the building and buildings and equipment.
Where did the 80% come from?
The 80% comes from this matter of bonding that I told you about, the debt. We borrow the money and pay for it out of student fees or out of income from the buildings. And then we have some gifts and grants involved in that.
One of the problems, let me just ask you, one of the problems of funding, and incidentally may I say that I hope your staff will prepare and put into an appendix the map that you have just showed me of buildings paid for and how they're paid for. Now, let's get on to government federal programs. For example, NASA or some National Science Foundation. Has that in any way put money into buildings at Purdue?
Oh, yes. Millions of dollars during the past period, last past 10 years that I've talked about. There have been many millions of dollars of federal funds put in. And, of course, this means, again, a lot of additional red tape and delay and problems and getting buildings started. For example, we have had a number of buildings that involve more than one federal agency. Perhaps the Higher Educational Facilities Act, perhaps NSF, perhaps NIH. And when you have more than one federal agency involved in giving you grant funds for facilities, this creates a tremendous problem because although you need the money desperately, they each have a different set of rules and regulations to follow, and in some cases they're conflicting and you have to work this all out. Yes, however, I should point out that this matter of federal funding for university buildings is now ending. There are no more funds. And as far as I can see into the immediate future, there are not going to be any very soon.
Mr. Freehafer, now we get down to the nitty-gritty of it. Would you, for the benefit of the record, just outline for us, let's say, a week's business, conferences, and just what do you do as treasurer?
Of course, there is never a typical week. Everyone is different, and every day is different. And they're a constant source of new problems and responsibilities coming along. Typically, I would spend some time each week on the construction program, either planning ahead or working on bids for a current project or reviewing plans for a building or something of this kind. I might, in any given week, have some security problems with safety and security. This comes particularly in the spring when we have student problems. I might meet with some trainees in our recruiting and training program in the business offices. I have a meeting of my senior staff about every 2 weeks. There may be problems of purchasing that would come up that have to be resolved. Unhappy vendors and things of this kind. Meetings with people regarding university real estate. Problems of personnel and employment, particularly in the business office. Problems of people that have been relieved from the university staff who don't think they should have been relieved, and so on. Typically, the president has a luncheon meeting on Monday each week with the vice presidents to review major problems. At that session, many of these things are discussed, and hopefully we do quite a little planning ahead in anticipation of potential problems at that time. During a week, there may be residence hall problems, there may be problems at the airport of various kinds. And of course, there's a continuing problem of controlling expenditures and attempting to meet emergencies that come along that involve both the physical plant and the purchasing and the financing to cover such emergencies. We have a continuing, ongoing study of our indirect costs so that we can negotiate with the federal government on an indirect cost rate for the following year. We almost always have two or three auditors here auditing our books, either the State Board of Accounts for the state of Indiana or outside auditors that audit all of our operations, like the residence halls and union on which there's a debt, so that they can report the operation to the trustees of the bond indentures. We have federal auditors here all the time auditing our research grants and contracts, fellowship grants, scholarship grants, and so on. So that it's a wide scope of problems continually. We, of course, have problems of maintaining our facilities, seeing that all utilities are in operation. We lose electricity, as we have once or twice. This affects so many things in the university. Research may be lost unless you immediately restore electric current. Students can't study, so on and on and on. The whole matter of telephone operation.
These are the kind of problems that you would work on every week. You mentioned senior staff. Does that include the heads of the financial offices and the regional campuses too?
Yes. This my senior staff consists of six people: the director of the physical plant, the business manager, the director of university residence halls and the Purdue Memorial Union, the director of the Purdue Airport and Service Enterprises, the internal auditor, and then Mr. Henschel, who is treasurer of the Research Foundation, sits in on all of our staff meetings because of the continuing relationships there. Probably I should say that most of these problems are resolved as well as they can be before they get to me. The ones that get to me are the ones that too often there's not a very good answer to. Have to make a decision in a gray area, and in many cases you can't be right either way.
And another thing too, in finance, the buck stops at this desk, doesn't
that's
it?
Right. I have to carry final responsibility, and if there's an expenditure made that shouldn't be made, why, it would be charged back on my bond, unless somebody else stole money or something. That
I remember a minor hassle you got into last year over the theater. As I understand, you just wanted to have university procedures and policies prescribed by law followed.
In that's right. And I had to, under my faithful performance bond, do something about it, or I would be liable.
Of course, what you were dealing with were a group of people who had no idea about such
things. And didn't care,
yes.
And misrepresented some facts, too, incidentally, but that's...
Well, this always happens.
Yeah.
What is the biggest pleasure you get out of this?
I've always worked under pressure, and I don't mind the pressure very much. I have learned to live with that kind of pressure, and it goes on not only during the working day, but evenings, and many times I get called in the middle of the night, too. I think the greatest pleasure is the fact that I feel like I'm contributing something to higher education. If I didn't feel that way, I shouldn't be here. And I think there's nothing more important, so that makes me feel good about the whole operation.
And then you would agree with President A. Lawrence Lowell, who at my graduation from college said, of course, we're interested in the arts and letters and creating humane problems. He said, nevertheless, I take considerable satisfaction in noting that we've had $9 million given to us in the last 2 weeks,
right,
and so on like this. Well, without what you do, you just couldn't run this place, could you? Now, there's been a charge leveled against Hubdy's administration. You don't have to deal with it, but I think you could, and I'd like to have it on the record. And that is, Purdue University has neglected to spend money in the areas of scientific and humanities development on the grounds that that higher education requires funds, and you have bent the or denied a development because financial considerations. This is the sort of thing that you hear from the faculty and students. Would you care to deal with this one?
Well, yes, I would just categorically deny this because I think the record will show that the increase in funds spent proportionately and the enrollments in the humanities and sciences have increased more, both the enrollments and the expenditure of funds have increased more in these areas in the last 10 years than the older schools of the university.
Nevertheless, though, isn't this the fact that the more students coming into these areas demanded that increase?
Well, first we had to have the curricula in order to do it. So you have to spend the money to get the faculty before you can handle the increases.
Then, in a way, what you're saying is something that I've had one or two other men on interviews remark about, and that is, they say that this is primarily engineering and science and must remain so that the first call for expenditure must go to the engineering and science areas, and others may wait.
Well, the record wouldn't show this. There have been greater, much, much greater increases in expenditures in the humanities than there have been engineering, if we want to use that as an example, proportionately.
There will be, of course, a statement, well, so what? We haven't got anything good yet. We have to build from nothing.
Well, of course, I think every school in the institution, and this is a continuing problem with any university administration, doesn't think they have enough of anything. I can't think of a single school that doesn't want another building, that doesn't want additional equipment, doesn't want additional faculty. And of course you want it this way. You want people pushing all the time for what they are interested in. But finally, the president has to make the horrifying decisions on distribution of funds. And I think his distribution will show, if you look at the record over the past 10 years, that he's given much, much more money to the humanities, for example, than proportionately he has to engineering or agriculture.
Well, he didn't have to with the development of the Krannert School because much of that was contributed, wasn't it?
That's
I would
right.
say of all the schools in this university, the Krannert has developed most rapidly.
That is right, because of the outside funding.
I think we used to call it generous benefactions.
Right, right.
while we're on this, is there any restriction financially on expenditure of money for one school or the other by law, or is this left to the trustees and the officers of the university?
It's left finally to the trustees. I think this is good. Who else can better make these judgments than the trustees on the recommendation of the president of the university? In some states, they make line item appropriations by schools and areas and so on. We have had historically one lump sum appropriation for the operation of the university, and the president and the board of trustees have had the responsibility and the authority to divide this among the various schools. Now there are a few minor line item appropriations for specific projects in agriculture, but these are more service type things. Not.
How would your job be affected if we would go into the kind of a state university system with a chancellor for all four schools, a committee, and a board of directors for all of the four schools, over and above the trustees serving each one?
Well, I think it would be more complex and cause me a lot more problems, because I would have to, shall we say, educate another group of people about Purdue University, its operations, its policies, its finances, and so on. And it takes quite a time to do this. A trustee, for example, it takes him 2 or 3 years to begin to understand the complexity of the university. If we have an outside group involved in this, I think it'll take several years of constant education to get them to understand what this means. And I think it would be a tremendous educational job, not only on my part as far as the finances are concerned, but also on the part of the president.
It would not then, from your point of view, be either efficient or desirable at this time?
Well, I don't think it would be either. However, I think we're going to have it, and I think we have to face up to it and make the most of it.
And of course, I know you're laying plans and preparing for that contingency.
Right, right.
Is a lot of contingency planning is your job too, isn't it?
Yes, and I'm always working on planning from 3 to 5 years ahead of time. We just are getting ready to submit, not later than the end of this month, our construction budgets for all the campuses for the biennium that will begin July 1, 1971 and run till 1973. Then after they authorize bond issues or make appropriations, the buildings have to be planned, and normally an academic building or faculty committees are involved and so on. It takes about a year to plan such a building, and it takes about 2 years or more to build it, so that you're always planning from 3 to 5 years ahead.
Yeah.
And you have to do this on your best information you have on enrollment projections, what type of facilities you need, and have them ready. It's been particularly difficult in the housing area on this campus. We don't have housing on the other campus, student housing. We have gone along and had unusual increases in enrollment and not been ready with a new housing project. Or we've gone along and we've built a new project and the enrollments haven't advanced as rapidly as possible, so we've had some vacancies on occasion. It's just almost impossible to hit it just exactly right.
Oh yeah, one would expect that. What's going to happen if the campus is split off into Northern Indiana University, say the Calumet campus, and Eastern at Fort Wayne and so on? What's going to happen there? Your responsibility would be...
Well, I assume if they'd split it off, I would be relieved of the financial responsibility, and there'd be a separate treasurer and a separate business operation.
Is that coming into reality soon?
It's a definite possibility. It's always discussed at each session of the General Assembly, and of course, we have the situation developing in Indianapolis where the two institutions have combined, and of course at Fort Wayne too, where we have a joint campus. Local chambers of commerce and so on, mayors and whatnot, and local citizens frequently are all for this idea of having their own, let's say, Indianapolis University. Faculty and students, on the other hand, are not too sure that they want to. It's not they want this. There's more prestige to being a professor, let's say, or a student at Indiana University or Purdue University than there would be for many years to being a professor or a student at Indianapolis University or Calumet University or whatever you want to call it. I don't know how this would be resolved. It obviously will be much more expensive because we do here at this campus a good deal of the, a good many of the administrative functions, financial and otherwise, centralized, which if they were spun off would have to be a separate and more costly operation.
Well,
it'll happen eventually. The question is when.
In other words, your headaches will be of a different nature.
That's right.
All right, is there anything more on this that we could touch on at the moment?
Well, I don't think of anything real fast.
Well, now there's always another question. This gets down to personal problems. What's been your biggest headache? The toughest job or your biggest headache since you've come on?
Well, I would say that during the period I've been vice president and treasurer, one of the biggest problems has been how to handle the various publics, let's say, that faculty, students, alumna, townspeople, parents, and so on, many of whom have conflicting ideas, and many of these groups want to participate in the operation. University.
Certainly, because your special function is in that portion of the anatomy that is always painful when touched,
that's
namely
right.
The pocketbook.
That's right.
Yep.
And perhaps one of the biggest problems is to try to educate the members of the faculty, and I've tried this through the University Senate and the Senate Resources Committee, to educate them on the financial problems of the university. In the first place, most of them are not interested except what their salary is and why doesn't somebody else cut something out and not bother us, and so on and so forth.
All right, let us continue then with the problem of educating your constituents to the problems of the university.
Last year, and year before, when the budget, internal budget of the university came up, we had a student faculty committee in both cases to review the figures. This took days and days of staff time, my staff, to explain the whole thing to the members of the faculty and the students who served on the so-called budget committee. And then they came up with the obvious answers that we had already come up with, and that was that faculty salaries were the first priority and so on down the list. Students have a misconception, of course, of the finances of the university, and many faculty do. It seems to me that rather than getting into the details of making a university budget, the faculty and student role should be to establish priorities, what they think are the most important items, and not get into the actual dollars and cents. And then the administration and the board can use this priority list as a guideline in setting up the budget within the amount of funds available.
I can think of one that is very important for Purdue. The sudden growth of the humanities school, for example, requires a very great growth in the library facilities due to the nature of their work. And I can think of that would be a typical problem, wouldn't it?
That would be.
How can we get more books all of a sudden
right.
to build up what has been neglected for 50 years for whatever reason? Suddenly this is, should be a very top priority.
That's
is
right.
This the sort of problem?
That's it. And does it rate priority-wise ahead of the next faculty salary increase? And where does the so-called bookstore rate in this priority list? The Faculty Senate at their last session this past year endorsed a university bookstore, recommended that we put $100,000 of university funds into it to set it up and start it, and said that it should be considered among other top priority items. Now, where does that rate in relation to funds to buy library books? $100,000 would buy several library books. Where does it rate as far as faculty salaries are concerned? Where does it rate as far as giving departments additional supply and expense and equipment money to handle the problem of inflation in the costs of supplies and so on? This is the type of thing that I think the faculty, if they want to participate in the financial operation of the university, could make a real contribution. I think they'd have difficulty arriving at some of these priorities, but then anyone does.
Yeah.
The board itself will have continuing difficulties in this direction.
And then really, one of your biggest jobs is education.
That's right. And of course, we have had a problem in this respect because of the way the turn the exponent has taken in the past few years in going for issues only and not news and so on, with the result that we've had to put out, and we started this past year, we put out two or three letters a year to parents. We put out several to outstanding leadership in the state of Indiana so they'll know what's going on at the university. We put out this student publication every week, and we try to keep the faculty informed too.
One of your difficult problems is the fact that you deal essentially with the dullest reading in the world, which is mainly financial columns. There's nothing sexy about it, and there's nothing particularly fascinating, and yet you have to translate that into very personal application, don't you?
That's right. And as a matter of fact, as I think I said before, a good high percentage of the faculty just are not interested.
They're not people who deal with money. If they did, they wouldn't be on the faculty.
Well, that could be.
It could be, darn well be. Okay, is there anything more in this line?
No, I think this is perhaps a major problem, trying to get all of these groups of people to understand.
Now, let's go to another one. Right in the same area. Has the nature of your major problems changed from that of your predecessor, R.B. Stewart?
Yes, in many ways. I think that we've already talked about the volume and the size and the great increase in the size of the university enrollment-wise, the size of the budget, the size of the physical plant, and so on. In addition to that, I think during this period of time, in the last 10 years, is when faculties and students have become more interested in participating in the governance of the university.
Decision-making.
And the decision-making process. And this makes it more complex, and much more slower. Faculties do not operate fast, as you know, and it takes an inordinate amount of time, and an inordinate amount of time of my staff to put the information together in a form that people can understand it and educate them.
One thing that is interesting is what you're building up is an answer to the accusation, oh, we can't do anything because the financial office says we can't.
And of course that isn't true except in cases where it's a violation of state law or of Board of Trustee policy. And of course the faculty participates in making policy.
Are the communications better than they used to be between the faculty, let us say, and its representatives and the trustees?
I think they're much better.
In other words, the trustees in a sense, I won't use the word enlightened, but they're more informed about faculty opinion now than they used to be.
I would put it the other way. I think the faculty is becoming more informed about the problems of policy making and running the university. I think the board has always been fairly well informed about faculty thinking in one way or another, usually by the president or the academic vice president or the vice president, dean of the graduate school, and so on. And the vice president from student affairs is kept them informed on student opinion and so on. I think the greatest advancement has been made on the other side of the picture, that faculties are becoming, some of them are becoming more knowledgeable about how the university operates.
All right. Now, what is our next topic on the agenda? Well, I always like to do two things. First, is there anything that we have left out that is not on our list that you'd like to put in? We'll close with a list of your honors and achievements. But first, before we come to this, is there anything you'd like to put on that we've neglected?
No, I don't.
With the understanding that when you edit this, you can always add to it.
Right.
All right, well then let's go into the, in a sense, we'll have in an appendix, of course, the list of your honors, titles, and national associations. Now let me start out. Are you listed in who's who? Are you a president? Are you a member of any national executive, group of university officers and so on? Will you please put that in for us?
Yes, I serve two terms as 2-3-year terms on the Committee on Government Relations of the National Association of College and University Business Officers, and served as chairman from 65 to 67. I have been for some time a member of the editorial advisory board for College and University Business magazine. I served as a member of the National Committee to revise volumes 1 and 2 of College and University Business Administration, which is the Bible for business administration of colleges and universities. And of course, I'm a member of the National and Central Associations of College and University Business Officers. I am in Who's Who. I think that...
Have you any addresses or papers that would appear in the appendix that you'd like to mention?
Yes. When we get into the matter of what has been accomplished at Purdue during my period here, I will have several. One is a pamphlet on our recruiting and training program,
That is recruiting and training for members of your
business staff.
Business staff. That will be appended.
Right.
Very good.
Also a copy of an article that appeared in College University Business regarding our executive development program in the business office, I think.
Excellent. Have you given any major speeches that you would like to remember?
Oh, I have talked to the Central Association of College and University Businesses, business officers. I've talked to on various training programs for such officers, usually along the line of executive development and training personnel, which we have been responsible for pioneering, and several things of this kind. I will look through my file and see if there's anything.
Well, those could be added, of course. We'd like to have all of them if you could.
Okay.
Now, as we close, let me ask you one job. Just two questions. One, what's going to be the future of this job? How will it, do you anticipate any great changes in function or direction of the treasurer and vice president for finance?
Well, based on the last 10 years that I've been vice president treasurer, I can only see more complexities, more problems, and a constant increase in size of the operation, unless and until we reach a point where we're willing to say, and I think we've almost reached that point, or will within another 3 or 4 years, where we can say that this is the limit of our enrollment.
At that time, there'll be a leveling off then.
Right.
All right. Now, this is always a question I ask everyone who's in administrative capacity, and of course, it's a loaded question. How do we compare in our financial administration with other Big Ten schools or other universities in the United States?
Well, casting aside humility, I think we have one of the 4 or 5 top business operations in the country. In the Big Ten, I think Michigan and Purdue are perhaps ahead of the other institutions.
Is this because of organization and direction?
Organization and direction and plowing new ground, starting new programs. For example, Purdue has pioneered in a number of fields. First of all, we were the first to assign business officers to schools and large departments to relieve the head of the department and the school from a lot of detailed financial work. We pioneered in the recruiting and training of business officers. We, in the early 60s, were faced, like all institutions, were expanding on 5 campuses, enrollments going up, and we just didn't have trained personnel to handle the problem. So we pioneered going out and recruiting like an ordinary business does. We send recruiters around, and then we bring the people in after they've gotten their degree. We send them around to other universities and colleges and take some of our own people here at Purdue, too, incidentally, out of the Krannert School. And then we bring them in and give them a training program and finally fit them into our organization so that now we're getting along pretty well in this problem of filling our jobs. Too many colleges and universities who train business office personnel just don't think in terms of a career in college and university business administration. And of course, we got a grant from an accounting firm, and I'll put this pamphlet on our recruiting and training program, Will Your Future Be As Exciting As Ours, which goes into this particular thing. We pioneered the executive training program. I set this up while I was still business manager of the university, before I became vice president and treasurer. This is picking outstanding junior and middle management, and we form them into a council, which turns over every couple of years, part of them. And we toss to them some of the problems that the university is faced with, and have them do research on it and come up with recommendations. Some of their recommendations have been good, and a fairly good percentage of them have been adopted. But the real basic purpose is the training of getting people to think in terms of the problems of the total university rather than their own little area. We have decentralized the administration of the university during the period we're talking about, in the sense that we've now decentralized budget making and things of this kind down to the deans and department heads, which hadn't been decentralized before. We developed one of the first manuals for business procedures and have kept it up to date, with the result that this is the only part of the Purdue University Code that has been constantly kept up to date for about 12 years now, and is still up to date. The rest of the university code is a shambles of that hasn't been revised. We developed the business staffs of the regional campuses so that I think that we have had developed a good operation. We've developed training programs for supervisors and foremen in the physical plant, in the residence halls, and so on. We've developed an outstanding program, training program for counselors in the residence halls. They come in about 10 days or 2 weeks before school opens, and we put them through a course that they really know something about the problems they're going to face and how to handle them and so on and so forth. We've shifted from the old machine accounting system to, so that our business operations now are on computers. Payrolls, accounting, and management information in general are now on the computers, so that this is handled more expeditiously. During this period, we developed the arrangement whereby faculty and other members of the staff can have their checks deposited directly in their bank account. We've also continued to study and upgrade the fringe benefit program of the university, which incidentally is one of the best in the country.
Well, is there anything more?
I don't think of anything else.
All right, now we can always come back and add to it in a further interview, but...
Or I can add some things when I...
When you, of course, when you edit it for the script, from the typescript, anything you've forgotten can be added to it, and I'll be very happy to come back and we can go on the tape again if you wish. Otherwise, may we conclude this interview? It's been most pleasant. And thank you very much for outlining the problems and your duties, Mr. Freehaver.
Thank you.